So here's a milestone. In 1960, there were just 3 billion people living on Earth. By 2011, the world population surpassed 7 billion. By 2100, the United Nations estimates that the world population could reach almost 11 billion. How to understand just what that means? Stephen Emmett has taken on that project with an interesting new book that is part PowerPoint presentation, part data visualization exercise, and part news headline. Emmett is head of Microsoft Research's Computational Science Laboratory in Cambridge, England. The book is called simply 10 Billion. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you really have a task here to describe something that we all understand. The climate is changing. The population is rising precipitously. But in some ways, the design of this book is trying to get at how people can really understand what that means. What did you set out to accomplish here?
Well, you're correct in as much as the design or the flavor of the book in how it's written is designed to be as accessible as possible to as many people as possible. It's certainly not aimed at scientists. It's even no. I would go as far as to say it's even aimed at people who wouldn't ordinarily read books. And I think it's because I wanted to try and get as many people as possible to think about the challenges that we face in ways that we're simply not thinking about them at the moment. And you outlined a few. That said, I'm not sure that I would go as far as to say the book is part PowerPoint and part.
Well, I say PowerPoint just because there are simple phrases on each page, you know, almost captions, and then lots of graphs,
right,
and then lots of extraordinary aerial shots which show, for instance, the scale of industrial agriculture,
yes,
which was responsible for growth of the population,
right,
at certain levels. I mean, you really sort of tell the story very, very well, but it really – it seems to me that the book is forcing you to visualize what's going on with the Earth as much as it is giving you some sort of analytical scientific explanation.
That's right. I mean, I think we need to be careful saying that there's no analysis. Behind the book, there's a lot of analysis. But in each – you know, as you point out, I cover a range of topics ranging from agriculture, water, energy, climate, land use, consumption, economics, politics. – And it would have been very easy to have written a 400 something page book on each one of those issues. But no one's going to read such a book,
right,
if you stitch it together. It'd be like, you know, some sort of 5,000 page tome. And so the trick was, and it's not clear to me whether it, I suppose time will tell whether I've in any sense accomplished it, to try and convey the breadth of issues that we face. In a way that, as I say, will reach as many people as possible.
Do you have to convince people for this book to be successful? It's not enough that simply people who already know this are intrigued and get to reiterate something they already believe.
No, I don't think – I mean, it's not about trying to convince people. It's just trying to set out the issues and people can take it, you know, or take it for what it's worth. It's interesting you may say convince people, because I think one of the reasons why pressure groups and green groups – failing in their efforts in these areas is it's all around trying to convince individuals of something. Mm. And I think that, you know, we're well beyond that time, actually, I think.
As I was reading and looking at the graphs, I was trying to think, what if you were writing a book for ants describing their explosive population growth and the various stages of the development that, you know, ants went from, you know, a billion to a trillion to however many quadrillion ants there are on the planet. In a sense, there's an assumption in this book that humans had some kind of control over restraining their demands for first food and then energy and now industrial consumption. When in fact, as you get into this book, you feel much more like we're powerless. We're just sort of a victim of our own desires, like the ants or like any other population species on Earth that just grows continuously.
Well, actually, on the contrary, I think instead of being powerless, we are deliberately driving the problems that we face. It's just that we seem not to care about them. I mean, we seem to have collectively decided to yawn about, for example, climate, and because we're simply not doing anything about it. But it doesn't mean to say we couldn't. We know that some of the problems that are related to that, like the fact that we're going to have to double agricultural production by 2050, okay, that might be something that not as many people know about as, for example, the climate. But how we're going to do that is anything but clear. Of course, advocates of this continuing, never-ending green revolution say, well, we've done it since the 1960s, we'll just carry on. And that kind of simple extrapolation is, in my view, not warranted.
Well, the graphs certainly give you a sense that there's got to be an upper limit somewhere, that we're going to smash against the ceiling here. But I'm wondering, when the decision, I mean, there was no decision taken, or at least you wouldn't have stopped to think, wow, we could grow 10 times as much food, you know, 100 years ago when that became the case and industrial agriculture happened.
Right.
Of course you'd want to do something like that. It's only now that you get to the point where you say, maybe we don't want to do X, Y, or Z, and we don't really have that skill.
No. I'm not sure that we don't have the skill to stop, it seems.
Yeah.
And nor do we have the skill to continue. We don't have the technology to continue, in my view, on the trajectory that we're currently on.
So will we get to 10 billion, or will something happen that basically, because if you look at the graph of population, there are some downturns, you know, in the medieval period, plagues, that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, it is possible that, for example, a new global pandemic could wipe out, you know, it might be a billion, certainly wouldn't be all 10 billion. But that's a bit of an unknown. I mean, it is true that increasingly epidemiologists say it's when, not if. It could be in 2200, it could be next week. But I think barring something like that, we can be fairly safe that we're going to reach at least 10 billion. I should say that as of today, we're on what the UN calls the constant fertility variant or fertility rate of birth rate per woman. And if that were to continue, and even I don't think this would happen, there would be 28 billion of us by the end of the century.
Well, if the pandemic population decline does happen next week, please come back.
I will.
Stephen Emmett is head of Microsoft Research's Computational Science Laboratory in Cambridge, England, professor of computational science at the University of Oxford. His new book is called 10 Billion. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, we're talking about the survival of AM radio. Can it survive? Is it doomed to the same technology limbo and interference that house fax machines, dial-up modems, and bikes with a huge front wheel? At least some of you still feel the love.
Hi, this is Donna calling from Seattle. I'm going to take you way back with AM radio. I remember sitting at the top of the stairs and sneaking a listen to The Shadow and Inner Sanctum and the Jack Benny Show when I was a very small child while my parents were listening to the radio downstairs.
J-E-L-L. Oh!
The Jell-O program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston and Phil Harris and his orchestra.
One of my favorite memories of AM radio was when I was in the third grade and my father helped me construct a crystal radio. Late at night, was listening to boxing matches of Rocky Marciano. That's a really special memory to me.
And this crowd has gone absolutely wild. 8, 9, Walcott hasn't moved. It's all over, all over. Winner and new heavyweight champion of the world, Rocky Marciano.
It's not interference. That AM signal and your memories of it, keep them coming. We love the stories. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a picture of your AM radio at facebook.com/The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.